I could have never imagined doing what we did. And what we did was we had basically a few family members. We didn't even do a service. He was in a room and he was in a cardboard casket. And we brought our pens and our paints and pencils, and we just drew on this box. And oh, so moving. Because it gave us a chance to connect with each other, with him.
This is Dishing Doulas Podcast with Joanne Hahn and Karen Hendrickson of Deaf Doula Network International, changing the world's approach to deaf and dying one conversation at a time. Seriously, let's talk. Whether you're an end-of-life professional, a family caregiver, or you simply want to gain comfort with end-of-life matters, we're here to help expand your comfort with our shared mortality, end-of-life planning, and the important conversations. The views shared in this podcast are solely those of the hosts and our guests and are for information purposes only. Be sure to consult with your own healthcare and legal professionals for any personal, medical, or legal advice. We are pleased to have Michelle Tiliakos with us on today's podcast.
Michelle's passion for advocacy and medical rights shines brightly, fueled by her personal journey of supporting her husband through the challenging terrain of a rare form of heart cancer. As a widow and mother of four children, she has experienced the depths of adversity firsthand. Yet, rather than allowing it to dim her spirit, Michelle invites others who have faced life's challenges to join her in crafting a future filled with brightness and hope, all while navigating the meaningful and everyday moments of life. With unwavering dedication, Michelle is committed to continually enhance perinatal education in ways that profoundly impact families, birth workers, and medical professionals alike. Through her work, she aspires to uplift and empower all those involved in the birthing process, ensuring that informed choice and holistic care are at the forefront. Join Michelle as she fearlessly champions the rights of individuals and families, and together, let's forge a path towards a future that embraces resilience, joy, and the transformative power of education. Welcome, Michelle. We're so excited to have you share your story with us today.
Thanks for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
It's such an important story, but I think first what's most important to first off is to have people understand a little bit about your background and your experience and what you do.
Yeah. Well, I'm a mother of four kids. In my background, I've done so many different things. I have all these hidden talents, hairdresser, bookkeeper, all these little things in the background. But my work for the last almost decade has been in birth and supporting people through doula work and also education and helping people advocate for what's right for them. And then there was a small bit of time and still continues on where I was helping people through perinatal loss. So that's miscarriage, stillbirth, and death within the first 30 days of life. And that started out of my first pregnancy ending in miscarriage. So I feel like the last few years has really been on both ends of the spectrum of birth and death. And this is what got me here.
So in some of your background, you've noted previously that you're a marine repair business owner as well. And so maybe you can share about that and how that ties in with your story and share about your journey with Steve, your husband, and his illness, and then life afterwards after his death. But maybe share a little bit with us about describing your marriage and your life and what that was like for all of you prior to Steve's diagnosis.
Yeah. So, you know, in 2005, oh God, it's even hard to remember the dates, but in 2005 and early 2006, Steve had registered a marine repair business with the government. And we thought, oh, we'll start something later. And what happened is the company that we were both working for, he's a marine mechanic and fixes boats. And I was doing some bookkeeping, that was going bankrupt. And so what was really exciting and also nerve-wracking at the time was I was pregnant. I was due in the spring, and he found out it was going bankrupt. He took out his tools, and we started the company the next day because the other company went under and all their stuff went into where the bailiff comes. So it was just by the skin of our teeth. And we started our company with $300 and a credit card. And that just grew into being such a community place to go in that industry. And I think it was really based on Steve's integrity. He really believed in the gentleman's handshake, using his skills to be same with everyone. He would sometimes get influenced these questions. Well, I have lots of money. Fit me in. I don't care. He was just integral around that. Like, I'm going to treat everybody the same, whether you got lots of money or you've saved so hard for this repair. And he really created a name for the business in the industry. And so I was the bookkeeper. I never loved that job. I was always waiting for, oh, when can I stop doing this? I just didn't let. And what I see is that I always had it that it was his business. And it wasn't, it was ours. And we did it together. And, you know, by me staying home and doing the bookkeeping allowed him to go to work and allowed me to take care of the kids. We, you know, from that moment, we went on and had more children. And it really was teamwork. And for how much I didn't love it, I can really see that we both helped each other through that. He could relax a little bit because I was doing the bookkeeping. By the time my fourth child came along, I'm like, no, I am really not doing this anymore. So we did hire someone, and that person just stayed with us for such a long time. He had such loyal staff and loyal customers. And so, yeah, that was the business. And he sold it in 2021 when he was diagnosed, but there was so much to learn there too. Even still now, I'm completing portions of that business. So yeah, but it was great. It was, I really say it was kind of like a boring job. And after he's passed, I love that there was no drama. It makes things that much easier for the difficulty it is. But yeah, that was, no drama is great when after somebody dies.
Yeah, it is. It is good. So, yeah. Michelle, can you tell us a little bit about Steve's illness and the diagnosis and how everything all began and came together?
Yeah, it was August 4th in 2020, and it was just after a long weekend and COVID was happening. And on the weekend, he said, I feel really sick. I don't feel up to myself. And he took us out anyways on a boat, and we went boating, and he was complaining that he didn't feel himself. And a lot of, over the last few weeks and months, he had just kept saying, I'm really tired. And we just thought, well, you've been in a physical job since your early 20s. You're getting older, even though now I know that 48 is not old, you know, he was 48. And yeah, we just kept chalking it up to he's working too much. And so that weekend happened. We went out on the boat. The next day we just rested like crazy. And both maybe were feeling sick. And then that was a holiday. And then on Tuesday he went into work and he texted me a few times and said, I just don't feel well. And then he had in the afternoon, one of his coworkers drive him to the hospital, and he thought he was having a heart attack because he said his back pain was just so incredible. And he just couldn't get rid of it. And so he went into the hospital, and I was out with the kids. We were out at a river playing in the water. And I know it's weird. I look back at it now. I'm like, why wasn't I there with him? But I think it was because COVID, and there was things that you could only stay for a couple hours. And I was like, when he texted me, he said, oh, Michelle, I saw a dove today. And I said, Steve, you're not dying. Just, you know, not in a condescending way, but just, no, you're fine. And I recently actually just went back and looked at the text messages back and forth. And yeah. And he was alone. His coworker dropped him off and he was there and messaging me back and forth. And he said, text me, he says, I have cancer and I'm sorry, I'm dying. And I just was by that time it was the evening, and I was walking with my child, one of my children. And I don't even know how I made it home, but I walked home. I dropped her off at home and I walked over to my neighbor's house and I just lost it. And somehow we picked up all of our stuff, my stuff, and took me to the hospital. My kid and my parents came over, and what we found, it was that they had seen blood clots in his heart. They were looking at his lungs, And what he was diagnosed with, not that night, but eventually, was cardiac synovial sarcoma, which is basically primary heart cancer, which is something that anybody I've talked to is like, I didn't know you could get cancer in the heart, even physicians, nurses. So that's what he had, was a tumor in his heart at that point. And the next morning, I was able to stay with him in the ER overnight. The medication or something was delusional, and then in the morning they put him into a coma, and he was in a coma for about a week while they figured out what was going on. So that was the initial introduction to cancer, really, in this close to my life. And yeah, what it all looked like.
And so you went from pretty much an everyday family living experience, husband goes off to work, not feeling 100%, not really thinking too much of it. We hear these kinds of stories of my partner ended up in the ER, and sometimes they individuals talk about this text sharing of what happens. Sometimes we hear things like, well, can you pick up a cart of milk when you come home? It's so ordinary, but it goes from so ordinary to so big in moments. Imagine. Can't imagine how that feels. Wow. And so can you tell us about, I can remember when I first met you, which was days prior to Steve's death, and you taught what has stuck with me since that first time in actually talking with you. I think it was even before we actually personally met face to face, you talked about love, connection, and vitality. And these three things being like the compass with respect to how you navigated this experience together. You want to share about that, please?
Yeah, I almost forgot about it. So thank you for bringing that up. Yeah, I think what happened right away was I knew when he was in a coma that he was going to have different opinions about what happened when he woke up. And, thinking about that, I thought he might be really angry. He might be upset. He might have different ideas of what I should have decided for his body. And inside of that, I also knew that I needed to take care of myself. And so I created this intention of living the rest of our lives like this because I didn't know what was next and what was up. And at first, the word vitality meant like he's got to live at all costs. That's what it meant to me, like alive. As long as he's alive, I can handle anything. And that really shifted for me for the duration of his life. Because it meant just feeling alive. And with that, it's like this torture, but this beauty in life of like, oh, I'm gonna feel all of the feels. And that's what it meant to be vital for me, was like the real, with what was happening, is like I needed to feel all the shitty feelings. They're really hard feelings I didn't even know existed. And that's what it meant to feel alive and be vital in that. It was like sharing all these emotions and these thoughts and this guttural, primal part that takes over you. And yeah, that's what really it was. And it was almost being scared and doing it anyways. You hear that, these kind of themes of generic quotes, and you're like, actually, that's true. Like, being scared and doing it anyways, because I had nothing to lose. What did I have to lose? Steve could die. So, what did I have to lose in what I was fighting for? And it
Right.
was really, I had nothing to lose. His life was on the line. I had nothing to lose by making requests, asking for things that I need, going to the healthcare providers and saying, I know this isn't what's typical, but let's do this. And I think there was also a freedom around that because his type of cancer was so rare. There wasn't a lot of stats on it. I think at the time we found like 100 people that had been diagnosed with it. And not that we actually found them, these are just numbers. And I think it did us a favor because had we had the stats of a very prominent cancer or disease where most people have this outcome and some people have this outcome, we would have instantly lived into that. Oh, this is our chances, 70-30, or, and the chances were not good in this, by the way. I think the life expectancy is less than 3 years. And, but also we just really were like, there's no, so what? There's 100 people. We can, they don't know. And we don't know. So why don't we just try for everything we want instead of listening to the professionals? You know what I mean? Because they didn't know either.
Right.
So I think that was on your side.
We've heard that before. We're not knowing the statistics or not knowing how bad things are can make things a little bit easier.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering here, Michelle, patient advocacy is an absolute necessity as a caregiver and a partner. So can you maybe share what you may have found a little bit easy or what was most challenging in that?
Well, I'll start off by saying I'm very good at communication and my doula work really helped me in this. And I don't know if I would have been as strong or clear if I didn't have those two things going for me. And working with pregnant families and babies, I'd seen so many different types of births and what's possible that it, this really helped me out here. And both of us, by the way, I know I talk about me, but, and with that, the, what helped was that. And while I say that, I don't feel like everybody should needs that. And so there's part of me that would get angry and confused because I have so much skill behind me and I can't imagine what it's like for others who don't have that skill. And yeah, that would make me mad because it's like, why do I have to work so hard? And I'm really skilled at this. I can't imagine what it would be like for other people who just don't know that they have choices or that they can ask questions or they don't have to take their doctor's advice. And we did that a few times. We declined some offerings. And it was really scary for Steve to trust me. And there was times he said, Michelle, I didn't believe you. I definitely thought I was going to die. This was within the first few weeks. And he goes, I just believed you guys. And so I would fake it. And it worked, you know, for a while. And advocating. So what I want to share about advocating, there's a few couple points of what really helped. And it helped me. And it wasn't necessarily that it made a difference in his life in that he's living now. But what worked was certain things that were important to me. Like I was more spiritual than Steve, but that was important to me in supporting him. And so we would do before he eventually accepted chemo. And before we did chemo, I wrote out an intention for the nurses to don't say these words. Don't bring up this if, you know, Steve will bring it up if he wants to. We're going to take a moment to pray over his medicine before you put it in his body. And there's parts too where we weren't allowed in the chemo ward, we're in the day ward. And so I would just, he would hold it up to the window and I could put my hands there and we would make it work the way we could make it work. And it made a big difference for me feeling a part of the process and doing what I could do so that I'm a solid person for Steve. That's one that really sticks out to me. And another one was, and we'll get to this later, I suppose, about how we ended up in Toronto. But there was one time that Steve wanted this test done while we were there. And the doctor was declining it. And I was starting to get really frustrated. And the parts of me too was like, oh, here's this wife who thinks she, this was the chatter going on in the back of my head. Here's this wife. Who does she think she is? She's not a medical provider. She's just being obsessive and possessive and wants to control. That's all this chatter. And I was like, no, Steve is asking for something. And at the moment, he couldn't talk at the time. And I was like, he wants that test. And the doctor just kind of used his body, came over and he said, listen, I've been doing this for 30 years and there's a risk of this and this and this. And he just used the intimidation. And I was like, I got it. And Steve's been in his body for 49 years. And when he says he can do something, I believe him. And my job is to make you believe him too. And oh God, that room, everybody went, their whole body scrunched up. And this was on a video call, by the way. And all the video, you could see their bodies. Everybody's like, oh God, what just happened? And the nurse is freaking out. And after, Steve was texting me, Michelle, stop, stop. They're getting angry. So we stopped the call and I hung up the call from that. And I was like, oh my God, I just messed up our relationship really bad. My husband doesn't like me. He's angry with me. And I was mad at him too, for not really standing in like what he wants. And for the next couple hours, we weren't together and at the point, and I was upset. And he phoned me later and he says, Michelle, I'm sorry. He goes, the nurse came up to me afterwards. She said, I've never seen anybody talk to a doctor like that. That was amazing. It was so great because it changed his perspective of what I had said and done. And you know what? The funny thing is, the test was ordered for the next morning. It worked. Yeah. And that's just a really great example of advocating for yourself does not have to be pretty and nice and like being polite and working with care providers. Like, you're working with them. But part of their job is to offer what's available and the alternatives and having a discussion about what's there and allowing the patient to choose. And I'm a huge believer in consent and informed consent and the laws around it that protect us as patients. And yeah, I'm really proud of that moment. I'm really proud of both of us because it was scary.
And so you should be. And you know what? Yeah. It is okay to question the medical staff. I mean, there was what, 100 documented cases, which isn't a lot.
Yeah.
Right? So he should have been maybe open a little bit more to trying something.
That one was more in his recovery, but yeah, like, and it goes from that too. How do we want to move forward in this rare cancer? I think along the way, I don't want to say we made mistakes, but I can see where I wavered in supporting Steve and what he wanted. And, you know, when he died, we were so clear that there was nothing in our space. So I can say that without going beating myself up or feeling sad about it or what we could have or would have done differently. We were clear on that, but there wasn't anything in our space when he died. Yeah, there's no regrets about it.
I think what I think is really important, and you highlighted it in this sharing that you just in telling this story with us, is how by speaking up, coming from a place of the best intention and love for our person, in speaking up, we can feel that there's this great risk with respect to the healthcare professionals looking after us, and also potentially a risk in our relationship with our person who we're trying to advocate for. In that story, the nurse definitely helped in bridging some of that piece with you and Steve, but oftentimes this is a difficult space for people. The person with the illness often can be fearful that, oh, now you've annoyed my care team. And now what does that mean with respect to my care? And we're truly coming from this place of love and good intention. You talked, I'll never forget this either, but, and this is how you said it to me on the phone, the first conversation we had, Steve and I are standing in what is possible and not what is probable.
Yep. Yeah. And I still live like that. And thanks for reminding me.
Yeah.
Because there's a certain resignation that people have around medical systems, around the way their ward works, the culture of the hospital, the culture of their clinic, whatever it is. And even the day he died, I could see this resignation that people have. And I'm like, screw that. We know what's probable. You don't have to tell us. You don't have to tell us he's most likely going to die. We know. You don't have to tell us that it's going to take hours to get this certain procedure done. Don't worry. We know. And it's almost like people want to fight for the probability. They're standing and like, no, that's the way life really is. And we were just like, no, that's not who we are. And we knew most likely he was going to die. We knew most likely this tumor was going to take his life. And we were like, we got it. You don't need to tell us. You don't need to You don't need to pamper us or feel sorry for us. We're totally clear that that's probable. And what we're doing is we're going to disrupt what it could be like for us. And that's where we stood a lot of the time, is the place of like, we're going for what's possible here. We've got everything at stake to try everything we know. I can say we did that. And I still work like that with my clients. I still work like that with the other birth workers that I know. We can have it. We know how the life is going to end, or the day, or your week, or your month. And you don't know. But most likely, if you're resigned to what it's going to be, that will be the way it turns out. But if you try going for something that's new, exciting, you have no idea, you don't know how, then I know we could say we did it all. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sometimes yeah. Probabilities limit what you can do, limit your mindset too. Somebody
and the
says,
people around you.
Absolutely. You know, somebody says, well, there's 100 documented cases. Chances are it's going to go like this. And you go, no, I'm going to change that. We're going to change that because we want to live vitality and all of that. Yeah. Makes a difference.
Mm-hmm. Are you open to sharing a little bit about your experience in Toronto?
Yeah. So where do I start? Steve declined chemo at first. And that looked like the doctor saying he has 3 months to live, but come back and get some chemo. We were like, thanks, but no, that doesn't sound very exciting at all. So he declined the chemo because he had been in a coma for almost a week. And then he was in the hospital, and then he walked out of the ICU. He didn't go to another ward. He walked out of the ICU. And we're like, thanks, but no thanks. That sounds like a really bad idea. And I think at the time it would have been, actually, like, he was so weak and he declined. He built up his strength. And by Christmas, he was like, I've never felt so good. I can't believe that there's a tumor growing in my body. And then he started to show signs that it was getting too big and his heart was not functioning as well. And there was, so we tried chemo. He tried chemo and he did that, and it wasn't proving effective at all. But we kept doing it because the doctors say do it until we can see if it's working for all this time. And Steve knew he wanted surgery from the very beginning. And what happened, we saw a surgeon here and he declined twice to do surgery and basically said, it's really risky. And so we said, okay. But somehow we found this doctor in Toronto. We flew there in September. And that was the first time we saw the doctor in person, was actually on surgery day. And by that point, Steve had gained about 30 kilos, I'm trying to think, of fluids from the heart failure. And that morning was incredibly scary. My kids were in Toronto with us. We were in a hotel. And the doctor said, yeah, there's a possibility we start this surgery and it doesn't get finished. And so I left the hospital. I don't even know how I was able to walk out of that hospital. I left the hospital, walked back to the hotel, and I spent the day with my kids just waiting for a phone call. And I thought, okay, if he doesn't call us by noon or 1 o'clock, okay, we've got past that really scary part and they're still working on it. I think the surgery in total was 13 hours.
Wow.
And they actually resected the whole tumor. They resected the whole tumor and it was over 4 pounds when it came out. Yeah. And wow. So from there, we thought we were going to stay about 3 weeks. Oh, just a typical heart surgery, but it was not. And we ended up being there for almost 2 months. Yeah. We were across the country, didn't know anybody in Toronto. My kids ended up going to another province and staying with family. It was insane. So I was in Toronto by myself and he was in the hospital by himself. And I knew at that point spiritually that this was going to be a massive point in my life in which things were never going to be the same, no matter what, whether he lived or died. I knew this was like, oh, something, this is pivotal for me. Yeah, it was alone. And as a mother of four, I kept going, can't wait to have some time off and be alone. And, you know, I thought I was going to get all this stuff accomplished while Steve was just recovering on a hospital. And And here I was going, oh, I did ask for time alone. I did ask for this. It just didn't wasn't supposed to be this way.
So as far as your children are involved, then Michelle, how involved were they in what was going on?
Well, they were separated from us while we were in Toronto. It was beautiful. Steve was diagnosed and we took him out of school. Maybe even they weren't in school because of COVID. That's hard to remember. And we just said, like, and that was all inside of that possibility of love, connection, and vitality. We are gonna create this with our family. And we didn't do big trips and all these adventures. We just hung out. And their school was like looking at Steve's blood work and look at this number's gone up and this one's gone down. And what does this blood actually mean? So we did a bit of homeschooling. Never said I would gonna be a homeschooling parent, but here we were. And they knew everything. We really kept them involved. Years prior, our dog had died, and we really wanted them to be a part of the process because we knew, oh, at some point someone's going to die and the kids need to know about death. And that dog really prepared us for this. We would reflect on the dog and we'd, okay, what does this mean? And yeah, we were very open with them. And I think we all needed that. I think maybe years from now that will be the right decision, and maybe years from now it might not, but that's what was felt right for us at the time.
I'm curious. Many people would suggest that children should be kept away from illness and suffering and not be invited to be close to death. And so, after your experience, what would you say the opportunity that it, and it seems kind of weird maybe to use the word opportunity, but by inviting your children into the process, by inviting your children to feel this love, this connection, and this intention on vitality by modeling for them this what's possible and what is probable and all of that experience. How do you feel, what opportunity do you feel that this has helped them with in relation to navigating where they are now today?
Yeah, it's been such a process because they did, each one of them individually dealt with it so differently. And I think there is an opportunity because, one, I'm a terrible faker. What's wrong with mom? You just would have been angry, lashing out. Just listen to your mom. I would have been a really bad mom. And so I think the opportunity for them is that they just have a better mom. And I know that's not necessarily what you're asking, but I wouldn't have been a good mom. And I can't say I was a great mom, but I did my best. And I know I did it the way I knew I could. And now it's 2 years since Steve passed. And there's a level of openness that we have. There's a funny sense of humor we have. I will share, they were younger than 10 and in their teens. That's the ages they were at. And yeah, that's a really beautiful question because I think that's not yet answered on what the opportunity was. I don't know yet what the opportunity was. And I do know it was the right decision for us in keeping them connected to what life and death means. And the beliefs around that, are we just a body that's here and then dead? And we don't believe that. We're like, something else is, there's too many things that went on after he died that just showed us we don't believe you're just a body here and then you're dead, a dead body.
And I think some of the beauty in the openness of it all, in the inviting them into that process, as much as you can invite them in based on right where they're at within their own ages and what have you, I think some of the beauty in that is that at least collectively as a family, you can laugh, share memory, be sad, and be open with respect to whatever those emotions are within your family without anybody feeling that they have to hide. And that to me, I feel anyways, just helps to foster this idea that we live with our grief in healthier ways than we might otherwise. And so along the way, you mentioned that when Steve was first diagnosed, you were introduced to a death doula, and then somebody referred you to me in the last maybe 10 days or so prior to Steve's death. And so can you share a little bit about how the involvement of a death doula, certainly at the end, I'll say in those end when that, because we spoke, you and I spoke, and then I did a follow-up a week or so later, and it was just after Steve had died. But we still did a little bit of work together, and we teed up a few things for you in the after death process, or what we call the after death process here. Can you tell me or tell us a little bit about how this may have made a difference for you?
Yeah, and you're bringing up things that I actually have forgotten about. I don't really, it's a bit of a blur that time. But what I've come to realize about end-of-life doulas and death doulas is I had this idea that it was for the person dying. And now what I really get is it's for the people who are living and how to plan. It's for both. I wish, no, I don't wish because I don't. I didn't get the difference an end-of-life doula would have made had it been weeks or months prior to his death instead of the week before. And I'm giggling a little bit because you're like that, like looking back, like, you don't know which way's up. You know, we had an indication that things were coming to an end. It wasn't like he died suddenly. We did have some indication, but I still also was standing in possibility. No, this is. We're still going towards what's not probable here. Some might people call that in denial, but I don't think that's what it was. And for me, it was like grounding. It settled my nervous system. Our conversations allowed me to explore what choices are. Even though there was this very heavy presence of what I should do, Steve and I talked about almost everything. And then when he died, I was like, I don't know what he wanted. Like, we talked about everything. But in that, what do you want me to do with your body? And what do you want people to come gather and see you? We didn't talk about that. And we talked about a funeral, and I just got this hard, I got this download. And I think it was you, but it might not have been. No, I can't remember, but I was thinking about a funeral, and I remember hearing Steve going, "Don't waste your time," which also meant don't waste your money, right? Like, was so funny. In that, and I remember laughing in the moment, going, "Yeah, no, that's a hard no." Steve says no, but this societal norm of what you're supposed to do, even though I hadn't been to a lot of funerals in my life, it was, "Oh, this is what I'm supposed to do." You get a body, it's done. You have a funeral in 4 days, 5 days, a week max. And I really got that that's not how it has to look. And that was a beautiful exploration that I would have never experienced if I didn't have an end-of-life doula. I'm also really proud of what it looked like to take care of him after his death, too. Yeah.
So, you and I, when we met in that week following Steve's death, we talked about the slowing down of the process, and not allowing the system to dictate how quickly you have to move and how quickly you have to have arrangements about where the body should go and what you're doing. And then we also talked about this potential opportunity of spending time with him. And you and the are you open to sharing that story of how that
Yeah.
came to be? So I referred you to another doula and a funeral director who helped to create this idea of possibility with respect to how you could intimately, as a family, honor, remember, and acknowledge. And so, are you open to sharing that time, that story?
I want to say yes. It's a bit nerve-wracking for me, and I'll say yes because what's there for me is not necessarily the viewpoint of what's in my life, but what's other people can choose. And I think I'm going to get over my own fear so that other people can, what's possible too. Yeah.
Thank
So
you.
thanks for asking.
So you had the opportunity for this viewing with Steve and the kids. And I remember you sharing the story with me afterwards about how surprising that opportunity actually really was for all of you, how you all had the opportunity to come together, to draw, to write, to share stories, even laughing and taking pictures are some of the words that you shared with me about that. And so from a place of possibility, what did that create for you in particular that maybe you wouldn't have imagined?
No, I could have never imagined doing what we did. And what we did was we had basically a few family members. We didn't even do a service. He was in a room and he was in a cardboard casket. And we brought our pens and our paints and I don't think we got crayons, but pencils. And we just drew on this box. And oh, so moving. Because it gave us a chance to connect with each other, with him. It wasn't scary at all. First, we had animal forest sounds playing in the background because he loved the outdoors. And then we put on some more dancey music and we were singing and dancing and drawing these pictures on this box. And my dad was there, and even my dad, we were just telling funny stories. And oh, it was so, and we brought our own herbs from our own garden, flowers. It was so beautiful. And I'm just so proud of my kids. And I think that would have just never happened. And if I hadn't had an end of life doula, I would have never thought of that by myself. Like when you're in crisis like that, the process of thinking about what you want or what you need, and forget creativity. You don't have a creative bone in your body. All you can figure out is how to eat. And even that, it's only how to eat, not what to make. And oh, wow. I've always been a bit of a person who doesn't do things as the normal people. But that was amazing, actually. It was beautiful. And I'm so glad we did that. And we have it that we're supposed to spend so much money on a funeral, get a big casket, or do the service this way. And I remember people saying, you and other professionals, is, oh, you don't have to have a service. You can do that later. And I remember thinking, oh, I better do it in the next month. Oh, I better do it in the next month. And I actually didn't have a celebration of life for a year. And I'm so glad I did that too, because it gave me a space to just be with my own grief, missing him, my own experience, absorbing what it was that I needed and what I was feeling. And then a year later, when we had this gathering, I could really hear people's sharing of him, this sharing of who he was for people. And if that was a funeral a week after, I couldn't have heard a thing. I would have never absorbed any of it. I wouldn't have heard any of it. And what a gift it was for me to pause myself. And actually, that was my theme for the year after he died, was the great pause. I could say no to a lot of things. And it felt great, because then I could say yes to all this other beautiful stuff. And so, yeah, his viewing, his, I don't know even what you want to call it, the day we were with his body, because it was just us and it was so beautiful. And the celebration a year later was beautiful. Yeah. It was a beautiful year, actually. Mm. Yeah.
And isn't there an irony in that you would use those words?
Oh, I blow myself away sometimes using the year and a half that he lived after he was diagnosed. It was 15 months. I was like, that was the best year in our relationship. That was the best. We got so flat on everything we needed to say. There was nothing left to be said when he died. Like, we're so flat. No regrets. I can't believe we did that. That was one of our biggest accomplishments. And then the year afterwards, I can see what I might have done differently than the rest of society of, okay, get back to work, do this. You got to take care of your kids. You got to do that. And I was just like, no, I'm going to pause. And It was so beautiful that year. And sometimes now I'm like, how do I get back to that feeling? Yeah, it was beautiful. It was full of grief, full of joy, full of happiness, sadness. Who the hell am I now? Who do I exist if I'm this new title widow? What does that mean? Because I had it that it was some feeble old lady with wearing black all the time. And I definitely didn't want to be that. Nothing against little old ladies in black, but I didn't want to be that. And so I was figuring out who I am was the most challenge that I've ever had in my life, but also the most amazing. Yeah, and I have so much, even Steve, I'll tell you a funny story. I think it was about 4 days after he died. I got to explore myself in a new way, and I wanted to replace my curtains for years. And every time when Steve was alive, I'd go, "What about these new curtains?" And he'd go, "They're great, Michelle. Get them. I love them. Do whatever you want, my love." That was always the thing. Do whatever you want, my love. And he didn't like them that much, so I wouldn't buy them, or I'd take them back or whatever. And then I'd come, "Oh, what about these curtains?" And he'd go, "Yeah, sure. They look great." And I'm like, was he really happy with those curtains? I wouldn't buy them. And then 4 days after he died, I was like, I freaking hate these curtains. And I just ripped them right down off the wall. I ripped them. And I was like, you know what? He didn't care. It was, I would do things based on what I thought he thought, not what he actually thought. And so it was this funny, just discovery of myself going, wow, all these years, I've just acted on what he thought, I thought he thought. Not what he actually thought. So I lived after that whole year afterwards. I had no curtains because then I couldn't decide which ones to buy.
So, do you have curtains now?
I have beautiful curtains. They're all the same throughout my whole house.
So, it's just been over 2 years since Steve's death. So, what have these past 2 years been like for you and your kids?
Well, I shared that first year, and especially the first 6 months were just this really beautiful space of receiving. It took something to receive. People wanted to contribute, and there was part of me who was like, I don't need this. I don't deserve this. It shouldn't be this way. And I can still have to consistently get over myself in order to receive. It's a beautiful, I think there's a huge gift for everyone involved when people are ready to contribute and they want to help, and you're okay with it receiving. I think receiving is harder than asking almost. Because asking, you figured out what you want, but somebody just giving you something because they want to give it to you, it's like, oh, I don't deserve that. I'm not good enough. There's all this strange chatter in our heads. But that was beautiful. And we just spent time with each other doing little trips. And there's no way I could have gone to work or done anything like that. But I still accomplished a lot. I accomplished a lot that first year. And then what was harder for me was about this time last year, January. So it had been a year since Steve died. And I really had it like, okay, it's a year. I've done my grieving, ready to move on. Let's go. And I just worked so hard in January, and I crashed in 30 days. I crashed hard. And it probably took me another 3 months to recover from that. I wasn't emotionally ready, physically ready. No, it was not good. And then for the next 3 months, I couldn't make it. I was in like decision paralysis. I could not make choices, couldn't make decisions. And I'm talking decisions like, should I go for a walk today or go to the grocery store? Insignificant decisions, couldn't make them. And then around June, so a year and a half after he died, I really started to see, oh, okay, what's my purpose here again? What lights me up and makes me happy and brings me joy? And I got myself into a course, into a program. And that weekend I saw what it was that I needed to do. And it's really to be with people and so that they see what's possible too. And so for the last 7, 8 months, I'm okay. Like now I can see, I don't know, I don't have all the answers, but I can see like, okay, this is who I am on my own. I still have a village. I have incredible support of friends and families and neighbors and people at our school the kids' schools, and it's like, okay, it still takes something, but it's becoming less and less challenging, and I'm not taken out so much by the emotions like I was before. Yeah, they still come, and I still think they shouldn't come now. But it's like, okay, here it is again. Oh, we got to deal with this again. Like, really? It's been 2 years. Shouldn't this all be solved by now? And it's not. Not. Yeah. So that's a brief sum up of the last 2 years, but I can kind of see myself in those phases of this amazing beauty and this pause. And in that pause, I just also, like I said, I got accomplished so much. I did things I would have never done. And for how much and how heartbreaking it is for Steve to not be here anymore, it's like, I also am so grateful for him because I just wouldn't be the woman I am today if he had been alive. And not his fault at all. It's just, I'm a different human being because he was here and because he's not.
And now you can even clean the hair out of the
Oh, so one of the things, I love that you said that because I need to do it right now. So one of the things that I hated was Steve died, and almost immediately the sink drain started backing up, and I'm like, are you kidding me? Now I got to do this crap too, like take care of the house. This is BS, you know. And every time that sink backs up, I'm like, Steve should be here. This should be his job. And yeah, I've been resisting all week, but I do have to clean the sink drain in the
It's funny.
bathroom. So, what we think is so inspiring about your story is, first off, the fact that you were faced with these really challenging circumstances, you and Steve, and were able to find this space that is difficult for us to find, to say we can do this and we can figure this out as we go, and get really clear on what mattered most to both of you in relation to treatment and care and how you navigated the process. And then what comes from that as well now, 2 years later, is it's such an inspiring story from the perspective of how we find this place of acceptance, I guess I would say acceptance of some of the hard stuff that life gives us, and how we can survive it in ways that are actually, and these are your words, beautiful, and allow us to grow and to experience things actually, quite honestly, on a deeper emotional level than maybe otherwise we would not have without having had the experience. It's a beautiful story, if that makes sense. That's how I feel that. So as we come to the close of our conversation today and all of your sharing, what are two things you really want listeners to get from our conversation today and your story?
I only get to say two.
You can say as many as you like.
Oh, we could be here for hours. One is that, and I think I might have already touched on this, but advocating. We don't have to get our information from one source, meaning it doesn't have to be from only your doctor or only the Cancer Society. Look outside of how other people are practicing taking care of themselves. You know, like one thing we didn't do is we didn't go to cancer support groups, and we didn't get in communication with other people with cancer. And it's not because we didn't want to be there and knowing their, you know, what they learned. But what we didn't want was the stories of people who were sick to infiltrate our mind. And it's not against anybody at all, by the way. But we decided to turn to the people who are healthy and look there. I don't know their past journeys, but they were healthy, and they, you know, going into a care provider's office who's happy to see you and say, hey, man, like, what's going on? Tell me what's going on. And people are excited to see you in a care provider's office. I want to be there. I don't want people walking in with their little manila folder and being like, so, how are you? Like, wow, talk about demoralizing, you know? Like, way to bring my energy down. Thanks for helping me get better. You know, like, it's just, I wasn't going to get better there. Like, you're already so sad, you know? So, yeah, really turning, and, you know, it's not going to be your doctor who's managed by their college. who tells you about traditional Chinese medicine or vitamins or different diets, that it's not going to be them. And that's okay. But if we take all of our information from one medical care provider or one way of thinking, we don't get to see the other options. And that's what we needed. You know, not everybody needs that. And the other part, so really that's in advocating for yourself and for the people you love, which we talked a lot about today. And then the other side is being open to receiving your village and creating that. There, when Steve was first diagnosed, I realized I need taking care of, and I reached out to a group of friends and I said, I need 30 minutes of phone call a day. And it's just for me to vent, to complain, to look for resources. I don't know how I'm going to show up. And that in that group, five people raised their hands within 5 minutes. And I had a call Monday to Friday. And to this day, I still have two calls a week with those people. And those calls were created just for me to show up. And what was really beautiful about that, and a side point, is that out of the five people who volunteered, four of them were men. And I love that, because this is a beautiful sign of like healthy masculinity, you know, that men reached out, said, yeah, I'll help a woman who's going through one of the hardest times of her lives and might cry. And, you know, I always had it that men just didn't know what they were dealing with when a woman's crying, you know. And like I said, I'm talking to two of them still to this day. Right. And that's three, almost 4 years later. Yeah, almost 4 years later. And the other two more things inside of creating your village is, one, being specific in what you want and being okay to ask for it, even if it's the person you're asking is not necessarily the person who's going to fulfill on it. So, you know what I need? I need food delivered. I need someone to help me clean my backyard. That was one I did last spring. Like, I'm having a weekend of cleaning my backyard. Who wants to help me? I could have never done that by myself. And then for people who want to contribute to someone who's going through something, also being specific in your offering. And one of the things I noticed that did not work was when people said, if you need anything, let me know. And I really get that their heart was behind it. But then what's happening is you're asking the person in the crisis to figure out what they need and want, and then go and figure out who to ask. It's too much. It's so overwhelming, because when people would offer that to me, I'd be like, great. Like, I need everything and I have no freaking idea what I need. And so it really helped when, and even I would give feedback if someone would say, if you need me to bring you dinner, let me know. And I'd be like, can you offer me 3 days and I'll pick one? Or can you tell me what kind of food you can bring and I'll pick one? And, or I can't do it right now. Can you call me back in 2 weeks and ask? Like, because there is a gift, like I said it before, in this giving and receiving, this interaction. And people, I want people to know who are in the crisis, that the people who want to give, they get to go home and say, oh my God, today I gave to Michelle and I brought her some food and her family looked really great. And they were all sitting on the couch, whatever it is. They're just like, I brought food to that family. And that's a gift to that person, because then they go tell other people, right, about how good they feel. And I think if we had more of that, it would be bringing back like that feeling of community and neighborhood and, you know, just popping over to bring something to somebody without feeling like, oh, I better wait until they reach out to me. That person's probably never going to reach out to you because they got too much going on. Right. So yeah, it's like, I encourage anybody to reach out to me and be like, how can I ask for help? Or how do I give purchase? Do it. Trust your gut and just go bring them a meal. The best was a friend came over, brought me a meal, but he came inside and he set my table.
Wow.
Like, not just brought me food, but like came in and set my table. And this was maybe the day after Steve died. So incredible when I can think of the times that I allowed myself to receive.
Yeah. People want to help. They do. Yeah.
And sometimes we just have to teach them how to help us.
And it's okay to ask for help. It's a strength, not a weakness.
Yeah.
You have to get over that mentality. It's better to give than to receive. Yeah. Not so much. You have to do it equally.
Yeah.
If you had one thing that you could offer up to healthcare professionals, Michelle?
Oh, God. That's a really great question. And I want to say this with kindness and love. You don't know everything. And you don't necessarily know what's better for your patient than the patient themselves. And so allowing patients to be free to make their own decision, they're not doing something wrong, is really gives them the space that's going to create health and wellness. No matter if they're dying or if they're on their way to recovery of some sort. Yeah. Allowing them to be powerful in their decisions.
I like that. Allowing them to be powerful in their decisions. Right?
Is there anything else you'd like to share?
Well, what an opportunity this is, allowing me to share my voice and my story and the work that you do in talking about death, dead. You know, all the words people don't want to hear. End of life. You know, what does it look like being ill or having a diagnosis is all an exploration of our mortality. And I don't think typically people are sitting around on a Friday night going, what are you going to do when it comes to the end of your life, you know? And by you doing this is maybe it becomes a conversation that people just have and they're not scared to have. So thank you for inviting me on here and allowing me to share.
I'd be curious, one last sort of quick thought if you have, and that is that, in all of the work that you do at that w a time when for many is a happy, joyous time, but also for some individuals it is not as well, the beginning of life. Would you agree with this idea that there are so many things that we need and that support us in that sort of anticipated joyous time of birth? That are also extremely relevant when we get to this other stage of things with respect to end of life.
Yeah, I really think those first few months after Steve died, I could only s describe it as what it was like to be postpartum, like just having a new baby. You're not sure who you are. You don't know where you fit in. There's not the joy around it, but there's this whole like it's a I do kind of say that birth now is a crisis because you're trying to figure out who you are and where you fit in and how you're supposed to manage it all and. What about my, you know, pregnancy? It's like, what about my body? And did I have surgery? And people are asking about the baby now and not me. And so postpartum is like this whole thing. Like, how do I clean my house? How do I have people over? How do I fit in here? And so there's no word for post-death. You know, we have postpartum and there's no word. I didn't find one for the living people after death in what that period of life it can be like. And I think they're so similar, even though they're the bookends to life, right? Like the beginning and the end, there's so much similarity. Yeah, a lot of similarity.
Thank you so much for sharing with us today. Last thing, any links? How can people contact you, follow you? Where can they find you?
Yeah, michelletiliakos.com. So TYLI. AKOS.com. And I'm on Instagram as Michelle_Tiliakos. And I do have a prenatal program that I teach, which is My Powerful Birth. And you can find that on the website and also on Instagram.
Catch the next episode of Dishing Doula's podcast and more at www.ddnint.com. And be sure to follow us on your favorite podcast platform. You can send any questions or comments to admin@ddnint.com and connect with us at Death Doula Network International on Facebook and Instagram. Thank you for listening to the Dishing Doulas podcast, where we're changing the world's approach to death and dying, one conversation at a time.